Hello, and welcome to Partners for Progressive Israel podcast. My name is Nicole Cooper, and I'm your host. I'm recording out of Jerusalem, Israel, in the Old City today with Rafat Sebleben. He is a Palestinian human rights activist from Jerusalem. He holds a master's degree in international human rights and humanitarian law from the University of Essex in the United Kingdom. He currently works as a legal research and advocacy officer for the Society of St. Eves, a Palestinian Catholic human rights organization. He is also a member of the Reith Sebleben family that is facing forced displacement by Israeli settlers and Israeli authorities. Before we get into the story, I just want to hear from Rafat about the Old City, about what it's like and what it is to live here.
So the Old City, from its name, is quite an old city. It's basically 1 square kilometers, a walled city, so it's within the walls. For me, it's been my home for as long as I can remember. There's something magical, let's say, about this city. That there's lots going on, lots of politics, lots of religion. There's lots of beauty as well, like in its alleyways, in its streets, and it's a very interesting experience to be in the old cities. You have all these different religions, all these different identities, all these people, all these foreigners and tourists that come every day. So there's something special about the city, yeah.
It is a beautiful, magical, and complicated place that has gone through many changes. How have you seen the place change over your lifetime, whether your own building or the city in general?
Okay, I guess in the past 20 years, like I'm 26, so I've been conscious for at least 20 of these 26, and self-aware of what's going around me. So I think in the past 20 years, this old city has changed a lot in terms of the settler expansion that you would see and notice. It's very noticeable the amount of Israeli flags, for example, that are hung on buildings. They are everywhere today. Whereas 20 years ago, they would seem less, in a sense. And part of it is due to the fact that settlers are more and more taking over houses in the old city. I would also say that in the past 20 years, that the Palestinian families within the old city are quite poor, and they're sort of discriminated against. And you can actually see it. You can just see it in how the people, in their clothing, their attire, in their way of life. It's something very noticeable to me. But yeah, that's the most remarkable thing, just how the city has changed its identity. It's the way you view it, the way you see it, it's becoming more and more an Israeli-dominated city. And you can actually see it, whether by the presence of the police, the Israeli army, the security personnel, it's very visible.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people have a really intense connection to the old city. Is it important for you and your family to live there? Is there a connection in a religious, spiritual, or historical, or all kind of ways?
So as I said in the beginning, the house, the old city for me is my home.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a personal connection aside from religious or anything else. It's something personal for me. It's my home. It's been my home ever since I can remember. In addition to that, it's also my mother's home. I mean, she was born in that host Al-Aqsa Mosque, which was one of the holiest places for Palestinian Muslims in Jerusalem, as well as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is very holy for Christian Palestinians as well.
Great, thank you for that. Now let's get into some of the details, facts, and figures. Noura Sebleben, Rafat's mother, has held property papers to the home since 1953. That's 62 years. Rafat, can you talk about the post-1948 Jordan's custodian of enemy property protected tenancy and how it works for families today, or how it worked in the past, along with the transfer to the Israeli guardian of absentee property after the war of 1967?
So I won't make it very complicated. I'll try to make it as simple as possible. But basically, after 1948, lots of Palestinians and Palestinian Jews back then, they fled from East Jerusalem. So lots of vacant properties were left behind. And what happens when Jordan took over East Jerusalem? So absentee property were properties owned by Palestinians who fled in 1948. Enemy property were property owned by Jews in 1948, given the animosity between Jordan and Israel back then. So in my family's case, they rented the house, as you said, in 1953, and they did it from the Judean government, the Hashemite kingdom. And it was classified as enemy property because pre-1948, a Jewish family used to live in the house.
Mm-hmm.
To our knowledge, it was owned by a Palestinian family, but leased to a Jewish family. But nevertheless, today in government classified it as enemy property. So Jordan was not really owned these properties, but only supervised them, and it leased them to Palestinian families who were living in Jerusalem in 1948. So all such properties in 1967, they passed to the Israeli government when they took over, when they occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank. So again, they don't own the property, they only supervise them until a resolution of the conflict takes place.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, the situation is that ever since Israel occupied the East Jerusalem and the West Bank, there was a systematic approach in trying to displace Palestinians, to get them to leave these properties and to have the Israeli government take over these properties. And in my time, this case, it started in the 1970s. In the beginning, the Israeli government, the body, which is the custodian of property, the general custodian of property, they rejected my family's request to do renovation work for the house. The ironic thing is that Jerusalem municipality itself, the Israeli one, they asked my family to hold renovation because the house was in quite a hazardous situation.
Mm.
And the walls were literally falling apart. So one Israeli body asks my family to renovate, then another one just refuses the whole thing. So my family had to actually relocate in the 1970s to a house in Beit Hanina temporarily until they try and manage with the renovation issue. But then in the late 1970s, so at the moment the building we live in is taken over by settlers, all of the building, with the last Palestinian family living in it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 1970s, the last Palestinian family living next to us was evicted. And the house was taken over by settlers. So what the settlers did back then, which was the early 80s, is they expanded the house and blocked the entrance into our house. So as I said, as of 1980, we couldn't access the house. We could no longer be in it. The settlers never took over the house, but we weren't allowed to go in.
Yeah, they put a lock on the door, right?
There was no door at all.
No, okay.
Because they expanded the kitchen. And it was part of the entrance was part of the kitchen now. So we didn't have a physical access into the house. The only way to access the house was jumping through the kitchen's window. And my family did that for a while until the settlers moved in. While they were doing the construction work, we could still access. But once they moved in, they didn't allow us to go into the house and jump into ours. So my family had to go to court as of the 1970s, first of all, to get the permission for the renovation work, and then to regain physical access into our house. Nevertheless, all through the 1970s, 80s, my family continued to pay rent, even though we couldn't physically access the house. And it continued like this until 2001.
Were you paying rent just so you could maintain the property?
Exactly. So
yeah.
So as I said, we're tenants of we don't own the house, we're leasing it with tenants. And under the lease agreement we have from Jordan, we're protected tenants.
Mm-hmm.
So a protected tenant is someone who cannot be evicted from their property as long as they continue to pay their rent. So if you stop paying your rent, you will basically be evicted from the house. That's one of the grounds to have someone evicted from their protected tenancy agreement. The other ground for eviction would be holding unauthorized maintenance work. So actually in 1970, when the Israeli government refused to allow my family to hold the maintenance work, it was either you move out of the property or you hold it unlicensed and get evicted. And that's actually a strategy that the Israeli government has used inside the old city. Lots of Palestinian families who hold similar protected tenancy status were evicted because they held unauthorized maintenance work. And the problem is they don't even allow them. They wouldn't be given the permission to hold this work in the first place. And the third ground for eviction would be deserting the property, which means that you would just leave the property, never intend to even come back and live there. So my family continued to pay rent. We didn't hold the unauthorized maintenance. However, we did. We had to relocate temporarily. However, the court did not take that into consideration. Eventually, after 25 years in court, an Israeli judge went to the house, wanted to see what we were talking about, and he had to jump from the settler's kitchen to get to access the house just to see it. And he said, this is illogical, there's no logic to this. And he ruled in favor of my family. He allowed us to reopen the entrance and to hold the maintenance work.
So how did you just walk into the, or how did he walk into the cellar house and go through their kitchen?
He had a court order, so he had to access it.
And when you guys were doing that as a family?
My mom and dad were with him, yeah, of course. They went with the judge to show him the house.
Mm-hmm.
For my family, no, they couldn't do it.
Yeah.
As of the 1980s, when the settlers moved in, there was no legal basis for us to ask the settlers to open the door and go through the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't let us anyway, so
yeah,
that's the issue. So I was, as I was saying, we moved back into the house in 2001. We lived there ever since, and we lived in relative peace until 2010. So what happened in 2010 is the Israeli General Custodian of Property, which is the governmental body, they gave ownership to Israeli individuals who are affiliated with Atayat Kohanim.
Mm-hmm.
The link is not very clear to us, but they are related somehow,
mm-hmm.
because they also appointed a settler called Eri Ital, who is affiliated with Atayat Kohanim, and he's the person in charge of the property as of 2010. So as of 2010, we were paying rent to this person, and we also pay rent through the means of registered post, because he wouldn't take it physically from us. And we need to prove we're paying the rent. So we send him
mm-hmm.
a registered post that he received this amount of money for rent.
Mm.
So immediately after they gained ownership of the property, Eli Tal and the settlers with him, they went to court and they asked the court to evict us. And the claim before the Israeli court was that we deserted the property and we never lived there since the 1990s, which was very absurd. Till 2001 was clear why we weren't living in the property. And after 2001, we were living there permanently. Like we've always been there. Everyone knows us. It's so absurd. So
yeah,
before
yeah,
the court,
I know I've been paying rent. And I know I belong
exactly.
here. Like, come on.
So the settlers testified. Settlers next door. They testified in front of the court. They don't know us. They never saw us.
Uh-huh.
And that we should be evicted because we don't live here. We deserted the property. We never came back. But they never saw us. And eventually, the court actually accepted their claims. In 2014, September, the Israeli magistrate court ruled in favor of the settlers to have us evicted.
Mm.
And it was solely based on the settlers' claims, in addition to the fact that the judge herself ruled for the eviction of the settler. So it's an impartial court from our point of view. There's no justice in that decision, and we immediately appealed the court decision to evict us. And at the moment, we have a scheduled appeal session on the 31st of May.
Mm-hmm.
And nevertheless, even though we have an appeal session that's scheduled, the settlers still wanted to evict us.
Mm-hmm.
And they attempted to do it two times, once in February, once in March. The first time, they showed up by themselves with a lawyer saying, you have to evict the property. We refused, of course, and some neighbors from around us, they gathered, as well as some activists, some press, and they had to back off. The second time in March, they came with the police escort, with almost 20 policemen and soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And the plan was to evict us by force. In the very last moment, before they were about to break through our door, our lawyer managed to get a temporary injunction from the Israeli District Court, which only lasted for one day. So after that, that eviction was stopped on that day. But ever since, we're open to eviction. An eviction could take place at any moment. So we're always ready to face an eviction, a third eviction attempt.
So in 2010 until 2014, was your family feeling the threat of eviction and just kind of going with it? Or did you feel more secure?
I think for my mom, she always felt the pressure. She always felt that the Israeli government and then the settlers were wanting to evict her.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the issue of being in court is just a way of adding a legal, of just legalizing the whole eviction
mm-hmm.
process. So even though my family was going to the courts, they knew that eventually that the court was not going to give them justice. They knew eventually that since they are the only Palestinian family left in this house, and the settlers really want to take over this house, that maybe at some point it's going to happen eventually. So they were always living under the constant threat of being evicted. And
mm-hmm.
and as I told you, like, even though we have an appeal session that's going to take place, the threat to evict us twice, and once with police escort, like, the Israeli government and its authorities are actually condoning it and approving it.
Mm-hmm. So how does that affect, you know, your psychology and your mom's, like, trying to go through your daily life with this pressure?
So we're living under constant fear.
Yeah.
So I live in the house with my mom, my dad, my brother's sister, and my brother's sons and his wife. So his sons, one of them is 9, one of them is 2. And the first eviction attempt in February, my 9-year-old nephew was homesick, didn't go to school, and he was alone when the settlers came.
Mm-hmm.
So he was terrified, of course. Although he felt strong, he called us. We immediately went to the house. And it affected him a lot, actually. That's just for a 9-year-old who doesn't really understand what's going around, doesn't understand the politics of what's happening. He just knows that settlers came to evict him for whatever reason. So it's difficult to try to explain to him what's happening. And it's even the same for my 2-year-old nephew.
Mm-hmm.
My 2-year-old nephew, whenever he sees a policeman in the street, he starts like saying, yeah, they are the ones who tried to evict us. He doesn't understand why or how, what's going on, but he knows that Israeli police tried to kick him out of his house, and he understands it. So yes, I can say in general, our family was quite affected. We're always living, like we're all childhood home. She was born in that house. She has lots of memories of her family, of growing up, of her mom who died in that house. So on the day of the eviction in March, she started crying hysterically. She was saying, this is the last time I'm going to see this house. I'm going to see these walls. I'm going to see this bed where mom died, you know.
Yeah.
So it was very emotional for her. And emotional for the rest of us, of course. I mean, the notion of being displaced, of being thrown in the street, and for such an unjust reason is just a bit too much. I think nobody should have to go through this experience.
Definitely. And so you kind of touched on this a bit, but the property is now in the hands of the settler group Atarat Kohanim?
Not directly.
No, not
it's
directly.
With settlers affiliated with Atarat Kohanim.
Okay.
However, there's also another layer that I have to talk about, which is, so the eviction, as I said, it's based on the issue of absentee property.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue of absentee property laws are quite discriminatory in the sense that if I'm a Palestinian who owns property pre-1948 in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, wherever, I'm not legally entitled to claim this property. So my family, for example, my family from my dad's side, they own a property that's also in the Old City and it's taken by settlers at the moment. So as of 1967, they couldn't claim the property because they're not legally entitled to.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I was Jewish, and if I own any property, or if I claim even that I own a property in anywhere in East Jerusalem or the West Bank, then I can actually claim it and go to courts to claim it. So the issue, there's a discrimination in terms of how the law is applied by itself.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was an alternative situation where both Jews and Palestinians can claim the property, then maybe it would make sense. But as the law is right now, it's purely discriminatory, it's purely racist, and there's no way to make it legal. So on one hand, if you're Jewish, you can claim the property. If you're Palestinian or non-Jewish, you cannot claim these properties.
Mm-hmm.
And this even applies to Palestinians in Israel who hold Israeli citizenships. They have properties in Nazareth, in Haifa. They can't claim these properties, and they're even classified as absentees. So
mm-hmm.
even though this person is living in Israel or in the West Bank, because lots of Palestinians in the West Bank own property in Jerusalem, for example,
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't be able to claim this property, and the Israeli government considers them as absentees. So even though I'm living in this country, I'm still classified as an absentee and wouldn't be able to claim my property, which is absurd.
It's very hypocritical and contradictory.
Exactly, yeah.
It's very frustrating.
Let's just jump back for a moment. How have you managed to have so many people supporting you in such successful campaigning? And how does it help?
So I think we're quite lucky,
yeah.
Given the fact that the nature of my work and my brother's work. So we both work in human rights organizations. We're very well connected. We have connections with press, with the human rights NGOs, with the local or international, and with lots of activists as well. So as I said, we're lucky in the terms of that we were able to actually gather people.
Mm-hmm.
There lots of eviction cases happened and nobody was present. Lots of house demolition cases happened almost, I think last year there was 120 demolitions in East Jerusalem, and nobody was present during
mm-hmm.
the demolitions. It's so again, we're lucky, we managed to have people come in support, in solidarity, and this is actually what stopped the first eviction. So if we didn't have enough people outside the house that day, we would have been evicted. And I think partially also in the second eviction, because having lots of journalists and activists outside the house and inside the house
mm-hmm.
delayed the eviction a couple of hours, but with a couple of hours when the lawyer obtained the injunction. So it was very crucial to have people show up in solidarity and in support. And it does help, at least in our case it did. Like it, the first time it stopped the eviction, the second time it delayed it until we managed to obtain an injunction from the court.
Mm-hmm. So does that feel inspiring to you? If you're up in the house and you look out and there's like 70 people on your street?
I mean, it definitely makes me feel that we're not alone, we're not deserted, mm-hmm. that people are actually, people care, whether it be locals or internationals who show up in solidarity. And it's important. Even after the eviction, we managed to rally up lots of diplomats, like from several consulates in Jerusalem. We had like the political consuls coming to our house to hear about the case, and they promised to follow up on the case as well. And that's sort of promising, although I'm not sure it's enough from let's say from third states.
Mm-hmm.
Like in terms of the size of their involvement, it should be a bit more. Like they have a responsibility to actually act against these actions because they are illegal under international law. And maybe there was correspondence between a couple of consulates and the Israeli government, I'm not sure. But I still think there should be more done.
Mm-hmm. What are you thinking is going to happen between now and May 31st?
So we're expecting that it's possible that a third eviction attempt may take place. We're expecting it to happen at any time. The first time, as I said, no one informed us of anything. The settlers showed up at our doorstep. The second time is the two policemen showed up the night before, and they told us that an eviction attempt is going to, the settlers and police are coming to evict you tomorrow, so prepare yourself, and things like, gather your stuff in. So they weren't supposed to tell us, they sort of told us like unofficially.
Interesting, do you know why?
So both of these policemen are actually Arabs. So I'm expecting that they came and told us like as a favor from them. But they're actually not legally obliged to. I'm not sure. We didn't get even a notification. They just came in their unofficial position. You know? They just came and told us. So if a third attempt is going to happen, I don't think we will be informed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're always on alert.
So do you have bags packed?
No. What happened is, the second eviction in March, my mom, she collected some of our valuable stuff, like old pictures, pictures of her family, pictures of her wedding, like, you know, just memories that you cannot bear losing.
Yeah.
And she put them in a bag.
Uh-huh.
And it was quite emotional for her, just the notion of, I'm going to be thrown in the street, I'm going to lose my childhood home, and I have to keep some memories with me, I cannot lose everything. And it happened to families in the Old City and in East Jerusalem. My mom's friend, she was evicted in 2004, I think, and they weren't prepared. No one gave a notification. The police showed up at their doorstep, and they also have a private contractor who comes to the house to get everything out, all the furniture, all the clothing, everything. So when my mom's friend was evicted, and she's our neighbor, by the way, when they got evicted, the private contractor, they took everything out, and they never found it again. So all their memories, all their papers, their valuables were lost. Lots of it was thrown in the trash. No one knew what happened to them. So on one hand, we know that it may happen, that if they come and evict us and succeed in doing it, we may lose all our memories. But we're not willing to show weakness. Like we're here, we'll hold as long as we can. And there's no way we're going to voluntarily leave the house. That's
mm-hmm.
something for sure. Like, if they evict us by force, it's something else. But voluntarily, we're not going to leave the house now.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't want to either. And that's kind of an interesting thing. You're saying, you know, we're strong and determined and we don't want to look weak. Because an opinion shared by most internationals that I know through my own volunteering, we're always just impressed and amazed at how so many Palestinians are so strong and so full of hope and determined to find justice in such bad circumstances. Can you maybe explain about the resistance? Yeah.
I think it's partially because we believe we have a just cause, and
mm-hmm.
that's the same for every Palestinian. So if you believe you're fighting and if you believe you're holding for a strong cause, then that will keep you strong as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. How would you win the court battle May 31st? Like, if you end up somehow not getting evicted, are you just safe for a while?
So if we don't get evicted and the appeal session takes place, so if the court rules in favor of the settlers again, in terms of it refuses our appeal, then they could come and evict us again. If it accepts our petition, then the eviction order will be cancelled. We're not sure if this is going to happen or not. What we are trying to do is, and what we think may help us, is gathering as much international solidarity and support as possible, getting as much media attention as possible. And this is what we've been doing in the past 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
So we started with an online campaign. We have an online campaign on Avaaz. We launched the petition, and so far we have 11,000 signatures from around the world. We managed to get lots of press attention, whether it be local or international, including also local Israeli news agencies. They covered the story. Lots of activists showed up. We regularly get all these foreign groups coming into our house, whether through organizations, whether through people who heard about the story. They come to our house, they express solidarity, they try, when they go back home, they try to raise the issue with their local governments, with their parliaments. And we've got responses actually from the UK parliament, because friends of mine and people who heard about the case in the UK, they tried to write to their MPs, and their MPs actually, they raised the issue with the Commonwealth Foreign Office, and they promised that they'll be following up the case with the Israeli side. So I think, yes, I think this is what's going to, if we create enough international pressure, then maybe the outcome of the court on the 31st of May may be different.
So do you hear that, listeners? You have to check out the website and sign and share with all your friends. And it's Avaaz, AVAAZ.org. And you just search for...
You can look for Stop Noura's Eviction on Facebook. And we have a link there for the petition.
Do you have any last thoughts or last things to say or what you hope for?
Probably I'm just going to repeat your call. I would ask everyone who's listening to raise the issue with the local parliaments, to raise the issue with the local Israeli embassy, to contact the media, to contact the press, let them know about what's happening, and to raise awareness about what's happening. I mean, our family is not the only family who's facing this threat, as you said. And I think it's about that time that the international community stands against these policies, against these actions, and take positive action, not just listen and see. They have to take positive action in such cases, because this unjust situation should not continue.
Yes, it definitely should not continue. And for listeners, if you want to know more about this particular case, just search Help Save Noura's Home online, and you'll be sure to find several articles. And there's also just lots of general information about house evictions in Israel and in Palestine.
So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Next week, I'll be talking to international activists who've been helping with the small village of Susia in the South Hebron Hills. The whole village is under threat of demolition. Be sure to listen. Thanks again. Bye for now.